evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C. South Africa says it is ready and proud to host the coming BRICS Nations Summit in August.
South Africa then have conceptualized a very critical, thematic approach for our chairship, which speaks about BRICS and Africa, a partnership for mutually accelerated growth, sustainable development, and inclusive multilateralism.
South Africa's Opposition Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF, will mark 10 years of its formation next week.
We have set ourselves certain targets, and part of those targets includes winning the electoral majority in South Africa. We have not yet won the electoral majority in South Africa, but there have been certain milestones that we've got to achieve.
And Zimbabwe's only female presidential candidate vows to win in the coming August general election.
We've been on the ground. We've been engaging with the voters. We are very much, committed to citizens' engagement. And this has been not a short period. For the past 25 months, we've been doing this.
Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. South Africa says it is ready and proud to host the upcoming BRICS Nations Summit in August. Alvin Boats, the Deputy Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, says the only African member of the BRICS Nations warmly welcomes and supports efforts by other African nations to become members of the group. Meanwhile, analysts say tensions appear to have eased after Russian President Vladimir Putin decided not to physically attend the summit. This following both local and international pressure for South Africa to arrest him if he comes. The Russian leader is accused by the Hague-based International Criminal Court of war crimes in the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. In an interview with me, Deputy Minister Alvin Boots outlined some of the discussions that will be held during the summit.
South Africa is privileged to be the only African country that are at the moment part of the BRICS organ, but more importantly, because of that reason, South Africa then have conceptualized a very critical, thematic approach for our chairship, which speaks about BRICS and Africa, a partnership for mutually accelerated growth, sustainable development, and inclusive multilateralism. Now, you would appreciate the centrality of that, Peter. When we speak about mutually accelerated growth, it's about recalibrating the economic landscape, post-COVID-19. When you speak about sustainable development, it's how do we harness the development dividend to achieve the sustainable development goals of 2030, which obviously have taken a backseat during the COVID-19.
So, Minister Boos, what do you think the anticipated impact of this year's summit will be for South Africa and by extension Africa?
There is key discussions on, the foundation values of BRICS. So the first issue, obviously, that we are going to discuss as one of the priority of our teams, it's about developing a partnership towards a equitable just transition. So that is key issue. And obviously, Peter, what we are looking at as one of the flagships is to probably convince and submit to our BRICS partners the centrality of having in place a just energy transition, African type of a center. Because the issues about the climate change affect substantively the African continent. So that is obviously the first priority. The second one is really about the transformation of education and skills development for the future. The third issue, obviously, Peter, will be to see how we present your African Continental Free Trade Agreement, your ACFTA, as a value proposition to other BRICS partners. What is the linkages towards Brazil, India, Russia, and China in relation to this, pan-African free trade, agreement that we have in place?
Now, looking at the deliverables, Minister Boot, a lot of African countries, I'm aware, want to join BRICS. What do you think the prospects are and the benefits?
Well, I think firstly, Peter, we have realized the significant interest in BRICS as a important opinion maker and body that seeks to alter the financial and economic architecture and, enhance political participation. South Africa has been a beneficiary of the expansion of BRICS. So we have been the first beneficiary of expansion. For us, the key issue about the expansion of BRICS since the time that South Africa joined BRICS is at the Sanya summit is in relation to upholding the declaration that reflects the vision and guiding principles of the BRICS partnership. So where we are, obviously, as South Africa, we are looking at the BRICS as an established forum for like-minded, progressive market and developing countries that are committed to restructure the global political, economic, and financial architecture so that it are more equitable, balanced, and representative. So we are elated that, we have experienced an array of requests to join BRICS. We do anticipate that the BRICS, summit that are being, provided over by heads of state and of government will obviously look at what should be our principled point. For example, there is a debate on what is the established guiding principles, what is the criteria, what is the standard, and what should be the expansion for membership, expansion. And that will obviously inform, I suppose, the substantive discussion, because that discussion has been preceded by a internal BRICS document entitled "The Strengthening of BRICS Institutional Development."
Alvin Boots is South Africa's Deputy Minister of International Relations and Cooperation. He spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. Still in South Africa, Opposition Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF, will mark 10 years of its formation next week. As part of the celebrations, the country's third largest opposition party plans to hold a rally at the First National Bank, or FNB, stadium in Johannesburg. Floyd Shivambu, the deputy president of the EFF, says since the group's formation in 2013, it is the only opposition party that has significantly held the executive to account for its actions. Expressing confidence that it remains the government in waiting, the EFF says it is committed to championing radical economic policies to help alleviate the suffering of the masses. It asks that as an international economic emancipation movement, it continues to seek to achieve economic freedom in Africa. For more on the prospects of the party and its performance since its formation, I reach Floyd Shivambu, Deputy EFF President, via Skype.
Well, the Economic Freedom Fighters was founded 10 years ago in July of 2013, here in South Africa, and we have set ourselves certain targets, and part of those targets includes winning the electoral majority in South Africa. We have not yet won the electoral majority in South Africa, but there have been certain milestones that we got to achieve because we are now the third biggest political party in South Africa, and we carry the most likelihood and possibility that we might be the biggest or the second biggest political party in the 2024 general elections. But we have got to be represented in all the municipalities in South Africa. Since our formation, Our clarion call has been to say that we should achieve economic emancipation, economic freedom in our lifetime, which is basically to say that the liberation movements defeated colonialism, they won against colonialism, but they've not been able to translate or transform this political power into economic power. So majority of black people, of the colonized people, have not been fully liberated.
Well, Mr. Shivambu, has the EFF been able to hold the ANC, and for that matter, the administration currently in Pretoria, accountable for its action, especially being an opposition party?
Yes, the EFF has been the most impactful opposition party in South Africa. We have been able to oversee the activities of government. We have been able to hold the executive accountable far much more impactfully. Before the arrival of the EFF in Parliament of South Africa and in different legislatures, and what distinguishes us from all these other political parties is that we do not just oppose for the sake of opposing. We always come with concrete, cogent, and coherent policy alternatives.
We heard about a possible alliance with some other political parties. People are suggesting that perhaps the second biggest opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, could feature well if the EFF really wants to defeat the ruling party, the African National Congress. Is this part of the plan? Because some people are suggesting that with the EFF stance of fighting for black people, it will be a sellout if you form an alliance with the EFF with the sole aim of unseating the ANC. Your thoughts?
Now, look, what we believe in as part of the alliances currently as the EFF is that we think that all opposition parties, after elections, must sit down to consolidate a common agenda on minimum demands and minimum aspirations to overthrow the ANC from power. We're unapologetic about that, because the ANC has been presented with an opportunity since 1994 to improve the lives of our people, but they've dismally failed. If anything, they chose a capitalist route, which somehow presupposed that by including certain sections of the black elite into capitalism, we're going to realize prosperity. And such has not been the case in South Africa. So we as the EFF, we believe that as a first step, we should consolidate all opposition parties to remove the ANC from power. We did that after the 2016 local government elections, where we supported candidates in more than 27 municipalities to vote out the ANC out of government in terms of what is expected. But it appears in the recent past that some opposition parties, particularly the white-dominated and white-controlled Democratic Alliance, they have described and characterized the EFF as their number one enemy, simply because of the fact that we are rising far much stronger above the Democratic Alliance. So they are threatened about our existence, but otherwise, our principled position is that we need to take the ANC out of power, because their task has been completed. They were just a liberation movement to fight against colonialism and apartheid. And they've demonstrated thus far that they've got no capacity, none whatsoever, to bring about economic emancipation, which is long overdue for the majority of our people. So that is basically our agenda. And we know that ultimately, the economic freedom fighters is going to win the government of South Africa outrightly.
What makes you that confident?
If you observe the trends of how the electoral politics have been going on in South Africa, is that all the major political parties have been declining in terms of the number of people who vote for them. But ourselves, if you gauge in our first participation in election, like we were founded in 2013, and we participated in the first general elections before we were even 1 year old, and we received 1.1 million votes.
Floyd Shivambu is the deputy president of South Africa's Opposition Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF. He spoke with me from Johannesburg. Zimbabwe, the only female presidential candidate, said she has intensified her campaign to win in the coming August general election. Elizabeth Valerio expresses confidence that voters will make a firm decision to make her the country's leader. Her remarks come after a court reversed the Electoral Commission's decision to exclude her in the polls. The court ruling effectively put her back on the ballot. To learn more about her electoral prospects and what she says makes her the best candidate to become the next president, I reach Elizabeth Valerio in the capital, Harare.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate that I've had to fight for the opportunity to contest and represent Zimbabwe in this election. So what happened was I did go through the process like everybody else on the 21st of June. I submitted my nomination papers. They were approved. However, the proof of payment that I submitted was rejected by the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission. So then I had to file an appeal, which we filed in the Electoral Court Division of the High Court. It took almost a month for us to have a hearing. And today we got the great news that the court had reviewed our case, and I received the judgment stating that my name will be added to the ballot as a presidential candidate in this election. So it's been a long process. I've lost a lot of time because I could have been campaigning all along like the other presidential candidates. But I am very thankful that justice has been served. We have been given this opportunity.
Looking at it, the setback you have, you know, for not being able to campaign during the period, what are the next steps forward for you in order to catch up in the run-up to the elections?
Well, so fortunately, as a political party, we did have already candidates contesting for the opportunity to serve in parliament, as well as for candidates who are going to, contest for the ward, you know, that they are representing. And this would be as councillors. So I think, you know, we've been on the ground. We've been engaging with the voters. We are very much, committed to citizens' engagement. And this has been not a short period. For the past 25 months, we've been doing this. So thankfully, we are, you know, we're still confident that we can win this election. I can become president of Zimbabwe. It's now up to the Zimbabwean citizens to decide if they want to have a very different, very new president represent them for the next 5 years.
Ms. Valerio, what makes you uniquely qualified to become the next president of Zimbabwe?
I think I'm the only one of the few presidential candidates who has a very short history in politics. I didn't start out my career wanting to become a politician. My participation in politics is directly as a result of the circumstances in our country. I'm concerned about the future of our country. I'm concerned about where we are going as a nation. And so I've only been in politics since we formed our political party. That makes me very different. I also am an established scientist, a conservationist. I have businesses that I have built. We are, you know, citizens who've known what it's like to operate in Zimbabwe and to try to, do all that you can to contribute towards building the nation. So I'm a presidential candidate that's coming to the table saying, even before we are in government, we are doing the work of building our nation.
The country has been governed or ruled by men, from President Robert Mugabe to now President Emmerson Mnangagwa. The society is dominated by men. What makes you think that Zimbabweans or voters will repose confidence in you to choose you as the next president?
Well, if you look at the demographics in Zimbabwe, more than half of our population is female. We are largely women in this country. But also, I think we've had 43 years of male-dominated leadership in government. And so at this point, it's well overdue. It's time for women to have an opportunity to lead and a woman to lead as president of this country. I think, you know, certainly, you know, the majority of Zimbabwe will tell you we've not progressed to the point where we would want to as a nation. So I bring something very different as a woman. And from the feedback we've had, I've traveled throughout this country. I've been in almost every constituency. I've met our voters. Most of them say they want something different, and they're relieved that it's a woman.
What realistic are your chances of winning the election? Because a lot of analysts, including some Zimbabweans, are talking about the ruling party, ZANU-PF, winning. They are also mentioning Nelson Chamisa's CCC as the party that can put a significant challenge to the dominance of the ZANU-PF. So what realistically are your chances of beating these two leading candidates to become the next president?
Well, the two parties you mentioned have been in government for decades, right? So the only political parties that we've had a choice of voting for as Zimbabwean citizens have been the two that most people point to. But there's never been a third political party that has capacity, that actually is building structures throughout its nation. As the United Zimbabwe Alliance, we have party members throughout Zimbabwe and around the world. We also have candidates now on the ballot in 60 constituencies. We would have had many more, but 73% of our candidates were rejected during the nomination process. We currently have 29 court cases pending for additional members of parliament that want to contest in this election on August 23rd. So, you know, we are the first political party to really come forward as a viable alternative.
Elizabeth Valerio is the only female presidential candidate in the coming Zimbabwe elections. She spoke with me from the capital, Harare. In Malawi, the former leader of the opposition United Democratic Front, or UDF, says he will challenge incumbent President Lazarus Chakwera in the coming 2025 general election. Businessman and former parliamentarian Atupele Muluzi says he has a track record of competence, untainted by corruption, and with the ability to implement policies to resolve the economic challenges facing the country. Muluzi, the son of former President Bakili Muluzi, studied economics and law in the United Kingdom. Critics say his swift change of mind after publicly announcing he was quitting politics for business makes him unsuitable to be the country's next president. But Atupele Muluzi tells me that calls by Malawians to help turn around prevailing economic conditions were the core reasons for returning to politics.
Absolutely. There's a reason why. Today, Malawi is now one of the top five poorest countries in the world. Our GDP capita is just under $500. Inflation is hovering around 29%. The current government had inherited a single-digit inflation just less than 3 years ago. There's high public debt that is crowding out private investment. And there's concerns over rising corruption and weak oversight institutions. And we appear not to be moving in a direction that will resolve this issue. In fact, what appears to be happening is there's a fixation on campaigning by the ruling party ahead of the next elections instead of focusing on finding solutions. So it is very, very difficult to sit on the sidelines and just watch what is happening to my country.
But Atupele, what makes you think that you are uniquely qualified to be the next president of Malawi, let's say in 2025?
Well, I have dedicated two decades of my life in the service of Malawi, defending and promoting democracy, transparency, accountability, and good governance. And I've served at the highest levels of government in various ministries in Malawi. And what I've noted is that one of the reasons why the country is failing is that we are seeing weakened democratic institutions, weakened oversight institutions. And this is what is contributing to this problem. And since the last elections, I've traveled extensively across nations to listen, learn from a number of international leaders and from successful and struggling democracies. Study how we can do things differently. And I think at this juncture, what is required in Malawi is an alternative voice that is giving an alternative plan, a different vision, and of course, giving hope to our people.
Critics of yours will say that UDF contributed significantly to the problems that you are talking about, and that UDF that took over from the one state president, the founding president, did not significantly improve the living standards of the Malawian people. Why should they trust you to do that?
Well, that's not correct. The UDF was the party that established the democratic institutions in Malawi, including the Anti-Corruption Bureau, the Malawi Human Rights Commission, and other governance institutions. It was the UDF that was the first party that governed in a democratic multi-party Malawi. So the UDF is very much accredited with democratic values and, of course, in setting up the governance institutions. What we need now is a different direction of ensuring that we further entrench the democratic values, including transparency and accountability. And of course, I'm very much a Democrat. And I believe that this is very important that we begin to ensure that we have stronger institutions, stronger oversight, stronger voices that are calling for change for in terms of what is failing in the country today.
Well, what do you say to those who are of the opinion that you said you quit politics after running for office and you decided to go on your own? So why should the people of Malawi trust you? Why should they repose confidence in you to be their next president?
You know, I'm someone who is committed to democratic values, including transparency and accountability. And I'm also someone that believes in the protection of private property. I also believe in the reform of our education and healthcare system. And I will fight to uphold the freedom of speech and association and basic fundamental human rights. This is what I've dedicated 2 decades of my political life defending and upholding in Malawi. And this is a conversation that needs to take place now. And we need to provide a platform for competent and hardworking and dedicated Malawians to begin to think about the future leadership of this country.
Atupele Muluzi is a former leader of the Malawian opposition party United Democratic Front, or UDF. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. In Sierra Leone, President Julius Maada Bio has announced the second batch of ministers to serve in his second 5-year term. Conspicuously missing are 17 former ministers from his first term, including individuals deemed allies and friends. Analysts say the president's new appointments appear to be inclusive, with a majority being people under 40 years of age, including females. David Senge is now the chief minister, a major promotion. He replaced Jacob Jusu Safa, seen as a close ally of the president. Senge was the minister for basic and senior secondary education and chief innovation officer for the Directorate of Science, Technology and Innovation in Bio's first term government. Observers say his performance during Bio's tenure significantly contributed to his promotion. For more reaction and analysis about the formation of the new government, I reach Ibrahim Tommy. He is the executive director of the Center for Accountability and Rule of Law.
Wow, it shows that the president is bold and is willing to grind the axe when he needs to. Clearly, he has sent a message by his current cabinet that he wants to break with the past, and he has, I guess, a different plan. He has a different idea of moving the country forward, and he wants to move the country forward based on the composition of this cabinet with young people and women. This is easily the most inclusive.
Now, so you have the communication minister being a young lady, the information minister being a young man, and then you have quite a number of young women and young men under the age of 40 in this new cabinet.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are very key appointments. And don't forget that the chief minister is also a young man under the age of 40 years. So clearly the theme of this cabinet is young people and women and inclusivity. You have people from different backgrounds across the country, men, women, young and not too young, who he has selected to join him and deliver his pre-election promises. It is really, really a bold statement. And a lot of people, I have to say, a lot of people, if not most Sierra Leoneans, are really excited about the prospect of, you know, working with these young leaders, young women. And don't forget that it's not just about the people he has appointed. In our parliament, we are going to have more women represented than ever before in the history of the country. So it's really an exciting period, and we are really optimistic that the future will be better with these young men and women, and indeed with the leadership of the president.
Well, some people have suggested that perhaps leading up to the election, one of the key accusations the opposition leveled against him, the president, was that the country was divided and that they were the only people pledged to unite the country. You talked about inclusivity. Could this have influenced the president, or you think the president is looking more towards building his legacy with this new selection of ministers to serve with him in this second term?
I think it's clearly a reflection of his pre-election promise, especially the promise contained in his manifesto about making sure that his government is inclusive. He's brought in people from other political parties like the NGC and even the NDE. The head of the sports ministry is from the NDE. Having said that, there's a main opposition, APC, who have said they are not going to participate in this government, and we have not seen any known member or supporter of the APC who has been brought on board. But that is not to say that the cabinet that he has put together is not inclusive, because we have people not only from other political parties, but from different geographical backgrounds. Every part of the country is represented in that cabinet. So again, in that regard, I think it is really, really inclusive. And what is really important going forward is for all of them to work together and get the required support from the people of Sierra Leone, hopefully the required resources needed to move things, to consolidate the gains in his first term, but more importantly, to transform a lot of things. He's got some ambitious plans for the next 5 years, and I think it is that ambitious plan that has informed the appointments that he has made.
There were people who were previously thought to be non-touchables, who were strong allies of the president, friends, some people call them, but they were nowhere to be found in this new administration. What happened?
I wouldn't know what happened, but at least it shows that he is one hell of an unpredictable person, in the sense that no one is safe with him. And I think what guides him is his conviction, it is his plan, his ideas, and where he sees the country. If he thinks that, based on his own conviction, that a group of people or someone cannot be part of his team, part of his vision, I think he'd never, ever hesitate to call the shots. And I think that is one thing that everyone is saying about him now, that he is brave, he's fearless, and can really wield the axe when he needs to.
Ibrahim Tomi is the executive director of the Center for Accountability and Rule of Law. He spoke with me from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown. To Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, this Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent, but first. In Nigeria, the main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, says the recent fuel price hike will bring untold hardship to citizens. The party says the recent removal of subsidies and the subsequent price hike is, quote, insensitive and callous. Displeased with the fuel price increase, the Labour Party rejected the move, saying it will negatively impact ordinary Nigerians. The remarks come after the government announced an increase in fuel prices from 73 cents to 80 cents per litre. The government is coming under criticism after the announcement, with the opposition describing the move as a provocation. They warn that the hike will be the beginning of increased hardship for the public. Debo Ologunagba is the National Publicity Secretary of the PDP. He tells me that the government must find a better way of solving the fuel hike problem.
It's callous, it's insensitive. And then the government in Nigeria, the APC government, has been comparing apples with oranges. But I think apples should be compared to apples.
What do you mean by that?
Okay, well, you know, they come up with this lame excuses and the argument about the fact that doing a comparison of fuel prices in, say, United States and Nigeria, and then they dollarize it. And then they look at the exchange rate of dollar and then say, oh, yeah, in America, they pay XYZ for a liter. But again, they blow the fact that in America, there are safety net provided for people that are poor. The government in America provides subsidy for agriculture, which means the food will be cheaper, and then the poor people can have access to the food. So indirectly, they benefit from that so-called subsidy. But here, nothing. There's no safety net.
So what do you think is the best solution to address this problem?
The best solution is to ensure that, one, you fight the corruption, and if indeed the fuel has been imported, at least in the meantime, to ensure that you shut down the corruption lines in the cut of the fuel supply. When you do that, then you accelerate the process of preparing at least one of the refineries, which means if they're refining with the supply chain and the byproduct from refining, other sectors of the economy will be at work, and then there'll be employment. And then, of course, the price of gasoline at the pumps will come down. These are simple economics.
But the government, the government is new and is trying to find its footing. The president is yet to name a cabinet to help him administer the affairs of the country. Wouldn't the PDP give him a little bit of time to put things in order?
If you don't want the heat, then don't go near the kitchen. The point is this. For anybody who campaigned to be president of Nigeria, obviously must have his own programs. And it will be not for how long do we wait for? In any event, it's a continuation of the old APC government. So to say it's a new government will not completely be true. Because the person there today was the leader, they called him the national leader of the APC at that time. So he was part of that government.
President Tinubu says that one of the things he's trying to do is to put in measures to ease the economic challenges Nigerians face. Isn't this a good step?
Look, anything that will benefit the life of Nigeria is a good step by anybody. But I'm saying you must have a well thought out program. The implementation must be humane. And this policy is ill thought, ill planned, and the implementation is hurried. You don't hurry things that affect people's life. You must be sensitive. Look, Ask any Nigerian, please, and find out what is the effect of this.
The House of Representatives resolved to set up an ad hoc committee to look into what they described as the incessant increase in fuel prices. This forms part of the effort, the government argues, to address this problem. What say you about this?
For me, without being pessimistic, this has been the same old story of investigation, of reviews, and all of that. But I'm saying there must be a concrete effort. The first point would be to look into what happens to an MPC. What have they been doing? In the last 8 years, how much did they pay for the so-called subsidy? How many liters of petrol was important to this country. These are the issues. Go there and investigate rather than just fighting a motion.
But Debo, didn't the PDP also promise to remove subsidy as argued by the APC?
Excuse me, as I said, it is ill-timed, is ill-thought-out, and hurried implementation. We said, of course, there will be a progressive process of removal. And the first point is to fight the corruption in the process through the NNPC. If you don't do that, we'll go back to the same circle. Yes, subsidy, if indeed it is there, will be removed. But the only way to remove that is to ensure that the supply process and the chain is effective. And then it's ridden of corruption. You remove it from there, and then it becomes easier.
Debo Ologunagba is the National Publicity Secretary of the PDP. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Uganda, the vice chairman of the National Broadcasters Association, or NAB, says its members from private media groups are not able to cover government activities due to a directive that bars state institutions from advertising on private media outlets. Dr. Innocent Nahabu says his group wants to engage the government to find an amicable solution to the impasse. His remarks come after the government directed state institutions not to use public funds to advertise with independent media houses, a move the Association of Broadcasters say is discriminatory and unconstitutional. But supporters of the government say they back the directive, arguing that private media houses often attack the administration for no good reason. Dr. Innocent Nahabu tells me that the NAB will seek legal redress if dialogue with the government fails to resolve its concerns.
It's more of us failing to be able to cover because the economy is not doing well. Even COVID phone when we were struggling, then we are doing a lot worse now. And government remains one of the biggest advertisers in small economy. Now, by issuing a directive that all our government advertising goes through the national broadcaster, which is UBC, it essentially means most people who only survive on government advertising will essentially get out of business. So it's very bad. It is both unfair and unconstitutional, because the constitution really tries to push that there's not supposed to be segregation in terms of business. And it actually does not even make sense, because the national broadcaster, it remains one of the least watched, the least consumed media.
Some people are suggesting that the move is to save money to use at some priority areas. Isn't this fair?
That's not true, because if it was a general austerity measure where government spending is being cut, that would be understood, that government is cutting across the board spending. But instead, we have so many government units, presidential advisors. The government continues to do workshops, which essentially are used to, you know, have people go for a workshop, get per diem. Even the government has a lot of vehicles. They are still buying new vehicles. Government is continuing to spend big. And on all other services, apart from the media, such as fuel, when they are driving those monster cars they drive, because the average minister is driving a 5,700cc car, on all those vehicles, they are paying. On the hotels where they do conferences, they are paying.
Is the action taken by the National Association of Broadcasters a tit for tat, a revenge perhaps, or a protest?
No. It is a form of industrial action by the players, because whereas we have 306 radio stations in this country and over 39 televisions, the government only owns less than 2% of them. So the rest are private broadcasters. So it's now essentially to protect the private broadcasting to say, okay, maybe government will be able to see us, because we have complained. We met the Prime Minister over this. We met the minister who is in charge of the of the docket, the Minister of ICT and National Guidance, where we fall. With them, we actually met even the UCC, who is the regulator. We have met them, but nothing has been done. The Prime Minister, when we met, she said that the issue was the presidential directive, and she was going to meet the president over it. We were expecting a response. That was in April, May. Up to now, nothing has happened. So this is...
How long do you think this protest is going to last?
We actually think the directive was interpreted by the players. The challenge is, of course, most of them are afraid to challenge any directive. When you read the directive itself, the spirit was in as far as in give the UBC, which is the national broadcaster, priority in giving business to be able to help it sustain itself, because it was complaining it was not having funding, and as such it was struggling.
So what is the next step forward for the National Association of Broadcasters to find ways of ending or resolving this impasse?
We prefer to use dialogue, so we hope that we shall continue to do dialogue. So we intend to continue reaching out to the people and ensuring that they respond. So that's our hope, that they will be able to see our point of view and respond accordingly. Should that fail, we think it's unconstitutional. We definitely have to seek legal redress.
Dr. Innocent Nahabwe is the Vice Chairman of the National Broadcasters Association, or NAB. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
As long as the energy for my cup we never finish. But in I feel I go talk and finish. See, girl, if you give me 1 minute, I convince you I am that confident. Be waiting on you for a couple minutes. No make a room, I go, they see me finish. Girl, if you will give me 1 minute, girl, I convince you I am that confident. I convince you I'm that confident. No matter what, they see me finish. I convince you I'm that confident. Something on my mind to make I tell you one time. Got some liquor and wine in my head, my guy. Tell me if you like. Say maybe we'll step outside. Can go right outside in the night time. In what's it been, in what's it go. We can give you up close, I'm pushing out something. Go sweet you like when I'm missing, got nothing. Can you know what's it been, can you know what's it go. We can give you up close, I'm pushing out something. Go sweet you like when I'm missing, got nothing. Excuse me please, my sister. Girl, I've been talking to you, you know no saying that me, they are not now. I didn't see your face on top my radar. I won't make you jam jam. Girl, as long as any money bent, you not go ever finish. But it's not get enough, it's been that finish. This kind of love, enough to show you finish. Don't see me finish. Because of the vibe I come by. I put this up, don't they comply. She didn't make me shout so divine. Aye, 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 aye. But in a field, I go talk and finish. See, girl, if you give me 1 minute, I convince you I'm not confident.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, real bad, oh, yeah, yeah. Open the door. Let me in, baby. Been knocking for too long. Tell me what's wrong.
to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C.
Confidential, only was an instrumental, yeah. Give me brains and intellectual, nothing easy, coincidental, yeah. If the guess that she wanted, I got a whole lot of them. I got a whole lot of them. I know if it's a whole lot of them. Ay, 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 ay. Girl, I'm no sober. Let me see ice and soda. Many things they go down. If you're on me, I'm my soldiers, yeah. Girl, you think that you want to? I got a whole lot. I got a whole lot of them. I know fit to hold all of them. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I say I put in 10 toes, now I don't blow. If that chick bad, I go carry her. My neck is cold, I don't come down. No bad energies, I run here. Yeah. Got a whole lot of vibes and a whole lot of them. Bad girls and a whole lot of them. Give me a wine and a whole lot of them.
I didn't feel your style when you break your back for me. Free me, you know easy. This thing plenty, check it easy. Plenty money for my baby. Make I know where you want to see me, baby. Then come easy. This thing plenty, check it easy. Plenty money for my love, but make I know where you want to see me, baby. You say you want the man, we go do you better. Oh no, what no, no, no. Sexy jala 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 jala. Come on and feel your style when you break it down for me.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mike Hove, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, eat with your enemies, but don't let them cook for you. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.